Hello, lovely people, and welcome back to another episode of Confessions of a PYP Teacher. This is Lou Gerlach with Think Chat, and welcome to Confession 132, where we're going to continue another deep dive into the fabulous book, Culturally Responsive Teaching and the Brain by Zaretta Hammond. This week will be full of insights about ourselves, and are you ready to go deep into your practice? To be honest, this chapter left me feeling a bit exposed, but I think that's the process of recognizing how our beliefs and behaviors shape cultural responsiveness or not. Yikes, yes, we already went there, my friends. But this is all about our growth into becoming more aware educators while honoring the things that we are also doing well. This is not about beating ourselves up. This is just about awareness so that we can become better. And Hammond begins this chapter by stating, the true power of culturally responsive teaching comes from being comfortable in your own skin because you are not a neutral party in the process. You can never take yourself out of the equation. And when I reflect on that, it's sometimes difficult to talk about things when society is so polarizing, because oftentimes when we express our views, we see it all the time. People are canceled or dropped, you know, from relationships or circles, or even within our context of schools. But at the same time, if we don't say anything and try to grow, we allow ourselves to be in a place where uncomfortable behavior persists, which will impact the next generation of young people. So we're treading lightly here. I really love this book because the way that Ms. Hammond approaches it, it's all about neurology, not about popular beliefs. And I think that's so important. She reminds us of the lizard brain, which is composed of the amygdala and the reticular activating system, or the RAS, or RAS, which has been created to protect us. And when we deal with uncomfortable situations such as this, it sounds an alarm within our bodies, to remind us that, you know, that we're getting too close to the danger that's outside. And this can come in many forms, but in this case, it's about us going into an uncomfortable place, possibly, and talking about topics that normally wouldn't be discussed in polite society. Let's be clear. This book is not about placing blame. It's all about awareness. It's about us being self-aware about our actions that we're not even aware of. That's what it is. We're not even aware we're doing these things. And I approach it that this book is helping me to reframe the conversation by beginning with intention. The intention is always about self-improvement. So I'm going to ask you, what do you want to learn more about while going through this book study? What do you want to learn about yourself? What do you want to learn about your actions? And how is that going to steer you into the right course? And so how does our culturally, let me back that up. How does our culture and our cultural identity shape the way we operate our classrooms? Because our history really impacts what we see, what we react to, and it stems from the prior work of what we talked about culture, that there's a surface, shallow, and deep culture. And we all have them. And Hammond asks some profound questions to guide this work of self-reflection. I am pulling out some questions that resonate with me and responding to them. Ooh, talk about vulnerability. And I really strongly encourage you to do the same. So let's start with surface cultural beliefs. Here are some questions that she posed that really resonated. How did your family identify ethnically or racially? That's interesting. Where did you live? Urban, suburban, or rural community? What is the story of your family in your country? Were you the first person to attend college? And who were the heroes celebrated in your family and or community? I looked at the first question, how did your family identify ethnically or racially? Because I think about my own racial identity. I grew up, ironically, in a rural and sometimes suburban areas as a young child within a tight familial network in South Korea, which is the land of my mother. And my father was from the United States in the US military. And when we were transferred back to California when I was 4.5 years old, many things changed for me. I ceased to have that familial network. I didn't have contact with any of those people ever again because I was so young. And as I grew up, I didn't have a connection with them, right? And the identity that I knew back in South Korea ceased to exist. And I was quickly taught that I must learn and lean into my American heritage to survive. And the stories that I was told about my mother growing up is that she was emotionally unstable. And I remember after my parents divorced, the narrative is that my mother went off to live a party lifestyle and that she re-entered into a second marriage, which failed epically because of her gambling and party lifestyle. So I had a disconnect from my biological mother because of the stories that I received, which were true, unfortunately. And she was able to find herself, thankfully. But these stories helped to create a narrative of, in my mind, about what it means to be Korean. That I couldn't lean into my Korean heritage because then I would be just like my mother. Think about that one. And what's really interesting is I really felt lost in this process. And then when my father remarried, I lost my story even still because I was now put into a full Caucasian household, full white household, where my cultural identity was morphing into a new culture. And we have, you know, as a society evolved, we're more accepting of other cultures coming into our countries with rapid rate of migration. And I think that we're aware more about language acquisition and more aware of the process and the value of honoring the primary language in the home. But what's really fascinates me in all this reflective process is that there's such a polarity of where we are identified. And I don't know if this is just in the United States, but I did experience it when I lived abroad, where people judged me based on how I looked rather than my mind, and also like attributed me to a certain way. And what I mean by that is that our own attitudes creates a narrative of what culture looks like. I can't tell you the number of times I've heard people say, you're in America now, you have to speak English, to new people that just are fresh off the boat. And having lived in non-English speaking places, I'm currently in Brussels, Belgium right now, And everyone speaks French on the street. Granted, most people speak English as well. And they also speak Dutch because they're amazing that way. But having lived in non-English speaking places where people don't speak English, I can clearly state that it's not always easy. And I was told when I lived in Germany, you're in Germany now, you need to learn to speak German. I had a strong desire for that additional language, but my brain had a difficulty processing it, especially because of the grammar structure. And so, thinking about that, what that frames our narrative of on a shallow level of what people should look and act like, right? I'm sorry, on a surface level. So now we're going to go into shallow cultural beliefs. And here are some questions that Emma poses that really struck with me. She asks, what family stories are regularly told and referenced? What message do they communicate about core values? How are you trained to respond to different emotional displays? What physical, social, or cultural attributes were praised in your community? Which ones were you taught to avoid? And as a young child, I remember that I was told to remain quiet at all costs from my mother, my grandmother, and teachers. My mother, because she didn't want me to get discriminated against. My grandmother, because that was the role of children at that time, to be seen and not heard. And my teachers, pretty much the same, so that I would become an academic, whatever that is. And I followed their lead to a fault where eventually I became a selective mute. I never spoke. And largely it was due to my Korean language and trying to acquire English. But I also didn't have a space to speak my primary language at home once my mother left. And so my means of expression died with the divorce. And so when I think about that, right, and the hearing the stories that you tell and your emotional displays, the reason I didn't have any emotional displays is because I had no words to display them. And while traveling through my educational journey, I discovered a false narrative that was imposed upon me regularly, that all Asian children are smart. And when I did not perform up to the expectations of teachers, I was frequently questioned on my level of Asianness. I cannot tell you how many times the teacher asked, "Are you sure you're Asian?" Because every Asian child I've taught has really been smart, and you're not that smart. So this implied that because I did not have the skills to express myself orally or academically, I was not smart. And I carried this mythology about myself for decades. And I think that's why when people praise me for deep connected ideas, I get shy and say, and I go and act humble is because I'm not used to people praising me for my success, more censuring me for my failures. That's deep, and that's about culture. So let's look at deep cultural beliefs. Hammond poses these questions, which I thought were wow. How did you become to believe this? What messages did you get about why other ethnic groups succeeded or not? What did your culture teach you about intelligence? Did you grow up believing some groups were smarter than others? As I grew up into young adulthood, I did a lot of reflective practice about the harm of cultural narrative. And by the time I was 10 years old, when my father remarried outside of my race, my new mother was Caucasian and had different stories to tell about her childhood in Utah. And during her childhood, it was a growing state with many possibilities, and it had people with similar points of view. And it was very familial and neighborhood and full of community spirit. And because of that, I wanted to be part of that because I felt so polarized as a young child with no linguistic connection. And through my experiences with my new mother, my viewpoints towards the world became even wider and whiter. I began to change the narrative in my mind that I didn't have to be the smartest in everything. I had the flexibility and freedom to try everything I wanted to do. Isn't that interesting? Because the white culture in their narrative says that the world is your oyster. My mom used to tell me that all the time. The world is your oyster, Lou. Well, Louisa, she's like, well, you can do whatever you want. You just need to figure out what it is you want. And I was raised with that mentality. And when you change from, oh, you have to be smart because of your race versus you can have anything you want, you start to believe that narrative. And what's really interesting, when people challenged my whiteness, because now I'm not white enough, right? Before I wasn't Asian enough. Now I'm not white enough. I stood up and clearly represented that half of me was white and half of me was Korean. And neither was less than the other, but I recognized that I needed to lean into my whiteness to survive and thrive in the 1990s America. And then ironically, as I entered the workforce, I leaned into my Asianness as so that I could get opportunities that way. And is that right or wrong? But this is called survival. And one thing that I learned in the whiteness is to fear others that look drastically different than you. I cannot tell you how many times I heard in the white community growing up, once again, in a very small suburban town of about 100,000 people at that time, in California, about the negative comments about Native Americans, because they were never in the conversation, even though they were there. It was about Latin American people, how they were lowly and how they took any job working in the fields and how they were causing Americans to lose their job. And then let's not even get started on Black people who were ignorant and chose to live in poverty and multi-generational poverty. And it was their choice. And these messages were permeating because of my whiteness. And what was really interesting is then becoming friends with people of those backgrounds and realizing their stories did not match up with what the stories that I had received. And so thinking about that, our cultural heritage really plays a huge impact on how we view our learners. So how do we unpack this interpretation? How do we deconstruct it? Because when I think about my childhood in the U.S. public school system, I connect to Hammond's cultural frames of reference. She refers to a story where a teacher gives a directive to a child to sit down, but they do it through a question format, which is opposite of how this child would operate at home. So the child said, no, thank you. And the teacher took that as a lack of compliance and sent this child to the principal's office. But as you peel back the layers, we discover that the teacher had a different cultural frame of reference of how to gain student compliance. And it wasn't the child's fault that they didn't know that's what they were looking for. They couldn't read the signs because there was a disconnect between how the subcultures communicated. This is huge. Because then we set up this false narrative that this culture or these children, particularly boys, right? These boys from this culture never listen. And we start that false narrative. And Hammond refers to a simple protocol created by Gudekunst and Kim in 2003 for widening our interpretive aperture to see what's truly going on. There's three simple steps, which are very hard. Because as a workshop leader, I do this all the time. And it's amazing how many teachers cannot do it. Because you'll see, I'll explain that in a minute. So there are three steps: description, interpretation, evaluation. So description, what do? We look at a situation that's in front of us and we describe what we see. Leave out any judgment, interpretation of the situation. Your own implicit bias will want to make assumptions, but you must not allow them to enter the conversation. You cannot look at past behavior, you're just looking at that current event and what you see. Interpretation. Now you interpret what's going on. Write down all your interpretations of the situation. What pattern do you see in your observations? Are some of them driven by your own cultural view of the world? Then evaluation. We're going to review again our interpretations. What do they say about your own views? How do they impact how you see your learners? And what judgments have been made? Now, what's really fascinating is I do a protocol in many workshops called See, Wonder, Think. I move it around instead of See, Think, Wonder. And I ask teachers to make careful observations of what they see in an image or a video. And then I ask them to write down their wonderings. So many questions imply what they think, and I have to throw it out because we are hardwired as a society from children's age to make assumptions. I hate to say it. We tell children all the time when we're teaching reading, oh, make a reference, inference, sorry. Make an inference. Tell me what's not being said that's not on the page. Okay, basically, it's an assumption. And so we do that in reading and we get them to make connections between how a character is acting, thinking, feeling, and why they did this act in the story. And yet we get angry at them when they make those same connections when they see friends on the playground and get in a fight because they saw two girls talking, pointing at her, pointing at the other one that got angry and she went and hit them. Well, you were making assumptions. You didn't have your information, but we train children to make assumptions and then go out into the greater world and continue it, right? So, thinking about that, this will help for you to remove your assumptions out of it. Ooh, it's going to be interesting. I'm planning to do this week to look at some of the things that I encounter because. Even in adult relationships, right? It's not just about school, it's about within the greater world. And I think this simple tool will help you to identify some patterns in your practice. And then hopefully, once again, it's all about becoming better, not breaking down the goodness that we are. It's about just making us better. So in the next episode, we're not done with this chapter. We're going to continue discussing our roles as culturally responsive educators and what we can do to spot our implicit bias. Because many of us, we don't know what we're doing. We don't see it. And but that doesn't also, as a knowing, seeing, thoughtful person, I also want to become better. And that's how I look at it. Of course, I'm going to make mistakes. I'm human. But as I evolve as a human, I want that to impact my practice. And so, my friends, this comes to the end of another wonderful episode. I hope that, oh my gosh, it was so rich. And I'm sorry I got so vulnerable, but you know what? This is how we grow and evolve as a practice. And I hope that you are equally open to the challenge of becoming vulnerable with yourself. Love you, and I hope that you'll go back and answer these questions and do a reflection and think about sharing what you know, what you learned about yourself. This is how you can help other people as well, such as I did. Have a lovely day, my friends.